Thank you very much for the intro. It's good to be back at Fields Institute. This talk is more of a broad intro talk geared more toward novice modelers, grad students, etc., to kind of give you an idea of different types of heterogeneities and how you model them and when is it important to include them. So because it's a math talk, I thought I would start with Shakespeare. So Shakespeare often ended his plays with a kind of an apology. If I've offended you, you know, please forgive me, I can make amends. I'm going to start my talk with a Shakespeare prologue, with a Shakespeare epilogue from The Tempest. If we shout and have offended, think but this and all is mended, that you have but slumber here while these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme, no more yielding but a dream. Gentles, do not reprehend, if you pardon, we will mend. So let me break that down for you. This is the biomathematics translation. This talk is based on a selective sampling of a broad literature, and I have my own biases. If you get annoyed as a result, pretend it was all just a bad dream, and we'll sort it out in question and answer. Having said that, we only have about an hour, so I'm going to try to plow through the whole talk, and if you do have questions and answers, hopefully there's time at the end. If not, we can talk about it over lunch. So I will start by talking about a model familiar to most of you, which is not heterogeneous at all. The basic SIR model with births and deaths, where individuals are either susceptible, infectious, or recovered. They're born at some rate, and you can assume that they die at the same per capita rate. And this is the system of equations that governs the SIR model. So this model is particularly well studied as a kind of archetype. It has a lot of it's complex enough to yield some interesting dynamics, but simple enough to be analyzed. For example, if this threshold beta over gamma plus mu is greater than 1, then you can have an endemic equilibrium. You can prove that it's globally asymptotically stable, etc. And this threshold also happens to be called the R0, or the average number of secondary infections produced by an infected person in an otherwise susceptible population. The endemic equilibrium is a stable spiral, so solutions dampen down to the endemic equilibrium. If you compute the time between outbreaks for a lot of diseases, it actually scales pretty well, predicts pretty well the time between outbreaks of real pediatric infections. So it's quite a useful model despite its simplicity. But it does make certain assumptions about homogeneity. In particular, a lot of the homogeneity stems from this term here. The rate of creation of new infecteds is equal to beta times S times I. In other words, there's a kind of picture that every time you have a susceptible person moving around randomly and bumping into an infected person, you have a new infection with some probability. This might not be a bad approximation for some populations. For example, for a very dense population and a highly transmissible infection that can be spread by aerosol particles, but it doesn't work all the time. I'd like to break down the assumptions in two ways. First of all, the assumption is made that you have a homogeneous mixing population. So everyone is the same, they make contacts the same way, they experience disease in the same way, etc. And then the processes are also homogeneous. So not only are you assuming that everyone is the same, you're assuming that they interact in the same way. And this distinction will be a little bit helpful later in terms of trying to explain when do you need to include heterogeneity and when do you not need to. So I'll give you two quick examples of how this assumption, cases where this assumption may not hold. One is the famous example of core groups. So a core group is a group that's responsible for persistence of infection in a population. And this is usually used in the context of sexually transmitted infections. In other words, if the core group were not there and were not transmitting, the infection would die out in the general population. So essentially this core group is basically seeding the rest of the population with infection. And this is one example of where heterogeneity matters. Because if you use a heterogeneous model, you're predicting persistence of the infection because you have this core group of mixers who are mixing with themselves and are making a lot of contacts and therefore transmitting a lot of infection. But if you were to average over the whole population and to get a single homogeneous population, then for certain parameter values, you would not predict persistence. And so there's an interesting example of a qualitative difference that can emerge for a model with heterogeneity versus without. Another quick example is spatial spread. So this plot shows the spread of rabies in New England, and you can see, as you can see, it's spreading outward in roughly concentric circles. And of course, if you want to know the speed with which rabies is going to spread and what the impact of control measures is, there's no way to get around having to include space in your model. So that's another example of where you have to include heterogeneities. So types of heterogeneity. There are certain types of heterogeneity that are very relevant for infectious diseases and which tend to get analyzed. So if you kind of imagine that you're taking your SIR model and then you're building heterogeneity into it, the first thing you do is you specify the heterogeneity in the population structure. So for example, you might stratify your population by space, whether it was in Toronto or Guelph. And that implies certain things about the way people make contact. Or you might have a more explicit stratification in terms of contact structure. For example, you might describe the population through a network, or each link in the network is sexual contact or household contact, etc. You might stratify by age, because your probability of being infected varies a lot according to age, and so do the consequences. Or you might stratify by risk, high risk versus low risk groups. So there are different ways to slice the pie, and you can do all of them or one of them. And then once you've stratified your population, you have to decide, well, are we going to assume that the mixing is dependent upon the stratification, which it generally is. So, for example, in the case of age structure, contacts are more frequent and more sloppy in the case of pediatric infectious diseases in schools than they are in adults. Okay, so children are much more likely to become infected and to infect for many infectious diseases. And there are also other types of phenomena that you can probably include under the umbrella term of heterogeneity, and that is when, for example, your parameter values change over time. So that's another assumption of the SIR model. The parameter values are always fixed, but in reality, they can change slowly or quickly. And one way to model that, if you don't want to make it a state variable, is by making it change, for example, according to the season. So, for example, beta, your transmission rate in the SIR model, could be a seasonally varying transmission rate. Another example is stochastic variability. So the SIR model essentially assumes that each second is the same as the next second, whereas, in fact, there can be changes which are best described or modeled as stochastic variability, so that each second is not the same as the next second. All these are things that sometimes matter and sometimes they don't. So there was a large expansion of research on heterogeneity, especially starting in the 80s and the 90s. But of course, infectious disease models have been around for a very long time, and they've gotten by quite well without heterogeneity. So, for example, arguably the first mathematical model of infections was by Bernoulli in 1760. And Bernoulli introduced what amounted to a compartmental model for smallpox transmission. And he had a very applied focus, actually. He wanted to demonstrate the impact of smallpox control measures on life expectancy. And then Hammer came along in the early 20th century. And at the time, there was a lot of debate about what is the cause of recurrent outbreaks. The school of thought led by Brown was that this is caused by seasonal variation in the susceptibility of the host. Other people, like Hammer, said actually you can explain it in terms of the inherent nonlinearity of disease transmission. So you don't have to force the system. It will oscillate based on the fact that transmission is inherently nonlinear. And he analyzed what amounted to a discrete-time model, not as we would recognize it today, but it was a discrete-time model of measles outbreaks. And this is a figure from his paper showing the typical London measles wave. And these measles time series, these waves, are studied still today. And Carmack and McKendrick, a bit later, 20 years later, essentially set out the modern foundations of epi theory in a series of papers. And this is kind of, I guess, the cornerstone of their work. This is an integral differential equation for the number of susceptibles over time. And this basically states that the rate at which susceptibles are disappearing due to infection is proportional to how many susceptibles you have now, times the integral from 0 to infinity of how many people were becoming infectious in the past and how their infectivity changes with according to how long they've been infected, where tau is the duration of infection. So that's the classic Carmack and McKendrick model, not the SIR model, even though it's sometimes referred to as such. And so a lot of modern epi-theory traces its real roots back to that paper. So we had basically from the time of Bernoulli to around the 80s, at which models were primarily focused on homogeneous mixing populations. And of course, there are a lot of exceptions, but you didn't really see that explosion until the 80s, and especially the 90s. So why did the earlier work not include heterogeneity from the outset? Well, there are good reasons for this. First of all, simple models can often explain as much as more complex ones. Okay, and that's something I can't emphasize enough to biologists, because the instinct of many biologists is to throw everything at the problem right away, put in every last detail, and oftentimes these details don't matter. So for example, take the Kerr-McKendrick model. They fitted that model to data from the Bombay plague. What you see here in the solid is the model prediction, and the dots are the data. And as you can see, it fits the data amazingly well. This is despite the fact that there are lots of things going on in this population. If there's a plague, people don't simply stay put. They move around. They take precautions. And of course, it's spreading in a population that's spatially structured, people with different ages, different contact patterns. Despite all that complexity, you can actually get the epidemic curve right with a simple model. And there's some interesting work by Jianhong Wu and colleagues where they fitted a simple model to a series of outputs from a more complex agent-based model, and of course they matched up perfectly. So when it comes to epidemic curves especially, compartmental models often do just fine, thank you very much. So this is one reason. It makes sense to start simple and then gradually build to make sure that you only include the amount of complexity that you really need. But the other reason is that, let me talk about it a bit more. To give you one example, a classic ODE model basically assumes an exponentially distributed duration spent in the infectious state. Okay, so what that means is that the basic SAR model I showed you essentially means that your probability of recovering after you've been sick for a day is the same as the probability if you've been sick for 5 days or 3 days. And of course, we know that's not true at all. If you've got a cold, you're going to be sick about, a week on average or 3 days. So there's a characteristic period that people remain sick for. What you can do is you can take the simple compartmental model and you can put that fact in. So you can include something like an Erlang distribution, which gives you a distribution like this. So most people stay sick, maybe 3 days a week. A few people recover quickly and some people take longer. That's a much more realistic description. And so there are many examples of looking at these distributed infectious periods in literature. And it turns out in a lot of cases, if you put that in the model, it doesn't really change much. It doesn't change your predicted endemic equilibrium, so the prevalence at the steady state, and it doesn't change your R0 value, which is really interesting. So why make your life difficult? Just go with this model if you know that. So that's one example. But there's an important caveat to the story, which we'll come to at the end of the talk. So the other reason why the early models didn't include heterogeneity is that because it's often much more difficult to analyze these models. So analysis of more complex models with all these heterogeneities in it are often restricted to simulation or specialized methods. And of course, as far as computer simulation goes, that wasn't even a remote possibility until the 80s anyway. It certainly would have been possible in the middle of the century when this was the state of the art in terms of computing. This is the ENIAC, and this is a guy changing one of the vacuum tubes. There are 19,000 vacuum tubes in the ENIAC, and if one broke, you had to find it and replace it. So things have improved a lot in terms of our computational ability. And the other issue with more complex models is that you often have to use specialized methods. Okay, so you often can't use this beautiful qualitative theory of ODEs that works for so many systems. You may have to resort to something like percolation theory or pair approximations. So let me give you one example of that demonstrates not only the complexity of dealing with highly heterogeneous systems, but also the kind of methods that you might use. So let's consider a kind of geographically structured population. So we have a lattice here. People are, the dark dots are infected persons, and the clear dots are susceptible persons. So you're either susceptible or infected. And infection is transmitted through the edges. And so this is an SIS infection. So people can get sick, and then they can recover again. Assume that the edgewise transmission rate is tau, and individuals recover at rate mu. And so how does that infection spread, and how would you model it? Let's start off just by doing the obvious thing. So let's write down the differential equation for the number of infected persons. So the two processes that can change the number of infected persons are recovery and infection. So individuals recover at rate mu, and there are I infected individuals. So the total rate of recovery is minus mu times I, the total rate at which individuals are recovering. How about infection? Well, you can only get infected through an edge. So the rate at which new infections are being created is the constant tau times the number of edges that have one infected and one susceptible person. So you're creating new infections at the rate tau times SI brackets, where SI bracket is the number of SI edges that you have in the whole population. Okay, so far so good. Now what do we do with this SI variable? Okay, well, one option is to go back to a mean field approximation. In other words, assume that the number of susceptible infected pairs is basically the product of the susceptibles times the product of the infected in the whole population. This is going back to the homogeneous mixing assumption. So I call it the mean field approximation. And we would go back to the basic SIR models with that. Or you can keep it, and so that would give you this equation here, which is basically part of an SIS model. Option two is to say, let's keep it, and let's try to derive an ODE for that. So what is the rate of change of the number of SI edges? Okay, so here's an SI edge here. What are the processes that can affect it? Well, an SI edge can be destroyed if that susceptible person is infected by this person. So in other words, you have to start thinking about triples when you're thinking about the pairs. Okay, so the rate at which SI pairs are being created depends on these triple quantities, which represent what's happening with these combinations of three individuals. So now you've introduced a variable ISI or SSI, et cetera, depending on what particular process you're modeling. What do you do with those? Okay, so you can again make an approximation. For example, you can express the number of SSI triples in terms of the number of SS pairs and SI pairs. And don't worry about the details of this equation. The main thing I want you to understand is that you can make some assumptions, some approximation that allows you to express the triples in terms of the pairs. And that gives you a closed system of equations that you can hopefully analyze. So in other words, correlations at level n depend on correlations at level n plus 1. So you have to truncate your hierarchy of equations to obtain a manageable system of ODEs. If you truncate at the mean field level, you have just two equations, S and I. At the pair level, you have 2 squared, which is 4 equations. At the triple level, you have 2 to the third, which is 8 equations. And at the n level, you have 2 to the n, which is lots of equations. I can prove that rigorously. Depending on the definition of lots. Okay, so as you can see, as you want to capture more and more spatial structure, you're going to need more and more equations, and it's growing exponentially with the number of variables. Now imagine that you have to do that, then you have to worry about age, risk. You know, this is hard. It's a hard problem. So this is the so-called curse of dimensionality, and that's behind most difficulties. Essentially, that's behind most difficulties of analyzing heterogeneous models. This curse of dimensionality. And in the case of pair approximations, it forces you to make Frankenstein-like, i.e. ad hoc approximations. But if you truncate at the pair level, you can still get some interesting insights. For example, think about what's happening in this little lattice model here. This guy's an infected one. This guy's an infected one. Or female, sorry. This person is political correctness, by the way. So here we have a cluster of infected persons. Now, because this infection is spreading spatially, infections tend to be clustered, at least initially. So this infected person is, if you think of it from the virus's point of view, the virus is trying to make contacts, and the virus is wasting contacts on people that have already been infected. So from the virus's point of view, spatial structure is a bad thing because they're just being sent out to people who are already colonized. And by the same token, this susceptible person here, they might get infected by this person, in which case this person's viruses are going to beat these person's viruses to the punch. Okay, so spatial structure, in effect, can slow down transmission. And you can use pair approximation methods to write down an expression for R0, which involves not only your transmission rate beta and your recovery rate nu, but also Q, which is the neighborhood size, and which reflects the extent to which spatial structure will slow down your infection transmission. Okay, so we've seen that there are different heights of heterogeneity. There's spatial, contact, age, and risk structure, and then you take your population, you stratify it, and then you decide what assumptions will you make about the mixing patterns that may be contingent upon that stratification. And then you also may need to worry about stochasticity or varying parameter values, etc. So in a nutshell, operationally, heterogeneity can be defined as anything that makes life for a modeler more difficult. So given that, when does heterogeneity matter? It would be nice to have kind of principles as you have in Newtonian physics to say, well, this is a case where you always need heterogeneity. But I don't think that's really the case, and the best we can hope for is rules of thumb. And the answer is really going to be highly contingent upon the questions and objectives of your modeling. For example, you might be interested in more of a didactic or conceptual model, or it might be more of an applied model, and your choice of model will vary according to those. So here's the remainder of the talk. I'm going to have to go through, I might have to skip a few of these in the time. So I'm going to talk about spatial structure, and then networks, age structure, risk structure, and stochasticity, and give you some examples of how heterogeneity matters in each of those. So first, spatial structure. So in the 90s, there was an editorial by Peter Kareva in Ecology, where he said space was the final frontier for ecological theory. And so in the 90s, as I mentioned, there was a lot of work in the effects of space on dynamics, especially in ecology. And this is a very nice editorial that describes that. So there are some broad lessons that seem to hold when we compare spatial systems to non-spatial systems. For example, in spatial systems, it is easier for coexistence, diversity, and altruism to develop. Let me give you one example. The Prisoner's Dilemma, which is a game where individuals have the opportunity to cooperate with their opponent or defect against them. And the payoffs for your actions are structured such that if you assume that people are paired randomly, it makes sense to defect. Because maybe you'll never see them again, for example, if you're thinking of a big city like Toronto. Now, if you play this game in a lattice, that changes dramatically, because normally cooperators, when they cooperate, they have the possibility of getting a good payoff if their opponent cooperates. But if their opponent defects, they have a possibility of a very low payoff. They will be punished for that. If you have a homogeneous thinking population, that means that on average, if everyone else is defecting, you're going to be playing against another defector and you're going to lose. But if you have a spatially structured population, suppose that you have four cooperators in this little tight cluster here, and they're repeating contacts with one another because you can only interact through the edges, they'll be interacting with other cooperators most of the time. And that means that cooperation will succeed and thrive. So that's essentially one of the mechanisms for which cooperation and altruism can develop. And basically all these mechanisms hinge on this repeated contact within a small neighborhood effect. So another example, compared to non-spatial models and spatially structured populations, the success of invasion is determined by the local spatial structure of clusters. Spatial structure impedes invasion by the pathogen. And this is what I talked about before. So if you want to understand the impact of a spatial spread of infection, you may need to consider not only fundamentals of the pathogen and the host, like recovery time and infectivity, but also the emergent properties of these clusters. Another example, if you look at systems where you have evolutionary host pathogen systems, you often find a critical transmissibility above which the pathogen dies out but the host survives. So we normally think that more transmissibility is good for the pathogen. But if the host can die as a result of the infection, what you can observe is that the pathogen basically overexploits the resource locally, and then all of a sudden it finds itself in a cluster where it's eaten through all the host and it has no one else to infect and it dies. That doesn't happen in the homogeneous mixing model because it can always jump somewhere else where you have some hosts. Compared to non-spatial populations, in spatially structured populations, epidemics have more realistic time series and critical community sizes. So for example, if you try to estimate the critical community size, the number of people that you need to sustain endemic transition of a disease, a homogeneous mixing model will predict a value that's too high, much more higher than we know from practice. If you make a spatially structured population, you model that as a kind of metapopulation, you get much more realistic critical community sizes because you can have rescue effects. So for example, if measles dies out in London, or maybe it's too dense a population, it probably wouldn't, but suppose it dies out in Cambridge, it can be reseeded by cases from London. So you can get the critical community size more accurate if you have a metapopulation model. Okay, the next set of examples is contact structure networks. And of course, this is not totally different from geographic space, because geographic space implies a certain contact structure. So when I say contact structure, I mean you're actually defining the network of contacts rather than some geography which implies certain contacts. So we can think of contact structure as a kind of network or lattice. And what are the effects? What are the effects of looking at transmission on a network? Well, as I mentioned, the SIR model makes a homogeneous mixing assumption for how people contact, which is not a terrible assumption for measles, but it's more problematic for sexually transmitted infections, because these compartmental models, in effect, essentially assume that partnerships don't exist and people have sex at random. But in actuality, we have a kind of network of partnerships here. These are actual components from a contact traced network for gonorrhea and chlamydia in Manitoba. And as you can see, you have two different components here. This one is radial, and this one is linear. And so depending on the structure of your network, you can have very different transmission patterns. And you would expect that the transmission in these networks, these components, would be very different too. So I'll give you one example from the case of HIV. So HIV prevalence now varies enormously across countries and within countries. For example, it's relatively low in heterosexual populations in North America, though it's rising, but it's very high in some countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And a number of hypotheses have been advanced for this differing prevalence. For example, people have considered have proposed the rate of partner acquisition, the core groups, the presence of other STIs that may amplify spread, for example, if they create lesions, or concurrency, which is overlapping partnerships. And this is one that has been modeled using a type of network approach. And this is relevant in this case because the total number of partners per person may not be dramatically higher in sub-Saharan Africa, but it is very common for men to take mistresses. And so you do have these overlapping partnerships. So it turns out that concurrency can impact the prevalence of an STI considerably. And I'm not just talking about having more partners overall. If you have more partners overall and they happen to be overlapping, of course that will increase disease transmission. But if you look at a model, and suppose you look at this situation here, we have six susceptible nodes and one infected node, and the same thing over here. In this case, the infected node is connected to all three susceptible nodes. In this case, it's more of a monogamous pattern, where you have three partners, but they're all separated out. So you can tell just by looking at this that this is going to create more infection than this, even though the number of partnerships is the same. In fact, what you can do is you can define an index of concurrency, which represents, for a given number of partnerships, how much overlap is there. As you increase concurrency, you have a few people with many partners, meaning that some other people have no partners. As you increase concurrency, you can get a bifurcation to an endemic equilibrium. And so for high concurrency, you can have endemic infection, and for low concurrency, you can have nothing. Okay, so that's one example of the impact of network structure on transmission. Another way of getting at this impact of partnerships is through pair models, and you'll probably hear more about this at 2 o'clock. The pair models are basically one way to capture serial monogamous sexual partnerships. And again, I don't really have time to unpack the equations for you, but basically you have single susceptible persons and single infected persons, and then you have pairs of two susceptibles, one susceptible and one infected, or two infected persons. And if you're looking at a serial monogamous population with no overlapping partnerships, you can write down the equations for that. It's not too unmanageable, and you can show some interesting things. For example, compared to a model with instantaneous contacts where there are no partnerships, like an SIS model, the prevalence won't always just increase, ramp up. It may actually decrease initially and then increase. So the initial evolution of the epidemic may differ. The exponential growth rate is lower, and the endemic equilibrium is higher. Okay, and this is all on account of having partnerships instead of not. Here's another example from HPV. So Heidi, who's sitting over there, developed a pair model of human papillomavirus and compared that to a model where you don't have pairs, where contacts are instantaneous. And the question was, you know, do you really need to include partnerships for modeling HPV transmission, which is sexually transmitted? And so there's plenty of literature showing that, you know, if you look at concurrency, you know, this changes, that changes. But there wasn't that much looking at the way people actually parameterize models. And the question we asked was, let's suppose you take a model, you parameterize it you fit it to pre-vaccine prevalence that you have from data. You do that with both a pair model and a non-pair model. So before vaccination is introduced, they agree exactly because you forced them to. Then you introduce the vaccine, and this is what happens. The prevalence declines. The different lines here are different rates of partnership turnover. One of the lines corresponds to partnership turnover every 6 months or a year, which is typical in certain age groups. At the other extreme, this line up here corresponds to essentially instantaneous partnerships. And as you can see, the duration of the partnership doesn't matter at all. So if you're going from a compartmental model to a pair model and you're calibrating, then you don't really need the pairs. But there's a twist in this story. If you look at a more complex network model, so you take a stochastic network model with other stuff like age structure, risk structure, and stochasticity, these do show a difference. Okay, so by kind of building up in these steps, we see, you know, at what stage does heterodata start to matter. So apparently pairs may not matter for a simpler treatment of the infection, but for more complex infection, there's some interaction with risk structure and pairs that's causing some discrepancy there. Another example from SARS. So when SARS outbreak began, R0 was estimated from epi curves, and the estimates range from 2.2 to 3.6. But something interesting happened. SARS did not spread as quickly or as far as it should have based on those R0s. These R0s are pretty large. They're in line with pandemic flu, and that's consistent with exponential growth. Such that, you know, pretty soon everyone should be infected. In actual fact, the number of cases that actually occurred were much lower than this, even before interventions were implemented. Now, why is that? There have been some explanations. One explanation is that the contact patterns, the network of contacts, influenced the fate of the outbreak. In particular, you might have two different places or settings, like a hospital versus a community, where the R0 is the same, the average number of secondary infections is the same, but they have different contact patterns. And even for the same R0, they can have different vulnerability to an epidemic, and if an epidemic does occur, they'll have different final sizes. In this study, they looked at several different types of networks, and they compared outbreaks on these networks for the same R0. So for example, here you have the transmissibility on the x-axis, and this vertical line corresponds to an R0 of 2.7. This green line is a power law network where most of the contacts are made by a few of the people. This here represents a Poisson network, the lavender one, and this here is probability of an epidemic. So as you can see, there's a huge difference in the probability of an epidemic under the power law network versus the Poisson network, and this is for the same R0. So how is that possible? Recall that R0 is the average number of secondary infections. So you're taking an implied average over stochastic realizations. And essentially what happens is that for some networks you might have no epidemic most of the time, but occasionally you have a very big one. Whereas a different network may predict that you always have a kind of middle-sized epidemic. So that goes back to the issue of estimating R0 from data, because if you're estimating R0 from an epi curve, you're estimating R0 from an epidemic that happened. But many epidemics would not have happened if, for example, if that pathogen had been released in a school or a community versus a hospital. So the implications are that, if possible, if you have an emerging infection, you should calculate not only R0, but also do some contact tracing to figure out what is the contact structure in this outbreak, and that will tell you whether or not we can expect this to be a characteristic example or an exception to the rule as far as the probability and size of an outbreak. Okay, let's shift gears now and talk a little about age structure. So the basic SIR model doesn't stratify the population by age, but it's relatively easy to do this. You can either write down a PDE model, or you can introduce a large system of ODEs. And so you can stratify your SI and R by age, and then introduce aging processes. So a settled person in year one, after a year, they become a settled person who is 2 years old, et cetera. A 2-year-old becomes a 3-year-old, et cetera. And these kinds of models are often useful when you want to look at scheduling issues, like should we vaccinate at age 9 instead of age 12? But there are also some dynamical implications. If the mixing is also age dependent, you have to determine how does age I mix with age J. And your assumed mixing pattern can influence the predicted dynamic and the impact of a vaccine or some other intervention. Consider these two cases here. Here we have the age of the infector and the age of the infectee. This is a case of strongly age-assortive mixing. This means that a 5-year-old is only going to infect another 5-year-old. A 10-year-old will only infect another 10-year-old. So people tend to assort very strongly with others of the same age. This is the homogeneous case where a 5-year-old is as likely to infect another 5-year-old as they are to infect a 50-year-old. Okay, so if you start to vaccinate in this population and you're vaccinating at a particular age, the predicted impact of the vaccine will vary a lot depending on what you assume about the contacts that are being made here. So, for example, if you vaccinate people at age 5, you can imagine that in this case, most of the effects of the vaccine will be felt in this age group, and these age classes will be relatively unaffected, so they won't really get much benefit from the vaccine. But in this case, if you vaccinate at age 5, because the mixing is more uniform, the effects of herd immunity will be distributed more broadly. So what you can do is you can assume some pattern for mixing. This is the so-called who acquires infection from whom matrix, and then you can fit that model to data. Essentially, it involves solving a system of linear equations. And these are two examples of waifu matrices, who acquires infection from whom matrices that often get used. And basically, each different color corresponds to a different assumed transmission rate. So if you have a 5x5 matrix with 5 possible transmission rates, and you have the force of infection for 5 age classes, that's a linear system that you can solve. And this was kind of the modus operandi for many years. There was an interesting diary-based survey in a large number of, I guess it was 10 or 15 European countries some years back, where they actually they gave people diaries and they asked them to track who are you talking to and what kind of contact is it and what do you think their age is and where did this happen. And these are examples of the age-mixing matrices for various countries, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Great Britain. And as you can see, this strongly age sort of mixing pattern is recovered. So people tend to mix with others of the same age. But you also see these interesting sidearms. So here you have a participant of age 0, actually a newborn. The parents are keeping track of the data for them, mixing with a 20-year-old. Here you have a 10-year-old mixing with someone who's 30 or 40. And there you have a 20-year-old mixing with someone who's 50. So these are our adult-child interactions, parent-child interactions in particular in the household. And these sidearms are completely missed by the who acquires infection from whom matrix. And yet, vaccinating children can have impacts on disease outcomes in adults, and the impact of the vaccine will change depending on whether you're incorporating these sidearms or not. Okay, so this is an interesting example, and I think these kinds of diary surveys are going to change the way age-structured models are used. We're probably going to see a lot fewer of these classical who acquires infection from whom matrices. Another nice example of relating to age structure, back to HPV. So HPV is a sexually transmitted infection. It's a necessary condition, i.e. a cause of cervical cancer. It's very common. About 70% of people will be exposed during their life, but it only results in cancer in a few cases. The infection progresses very gradually through over a series of years or decades through low-grade lesions to high-grade lesions and eventually to cervical cancer. And infection by HPV as well as the lesions and the cancer can be prevented by vaccines. At least a lot of the infections and cancer can. So one question that modelers have been asked lately is, okay, we have this vaccine. It's being implemented now, but there's a big lag in a lot of these outcomes. And some of the outcomes are 20 years down the road, like the cancer, and some are 5 years down the road, like the lesions. When will we start to see changes in how many women have lesions, how many women have abnormal pap smears, et cetera? And so what you can do is you can build a sexual partnership network that can capture the effect of the vaccine on infection in different age classes. And here's one example of the output. So vaccination starts in 2007, and the different lines here correspond to the prevalence of type 16 infection in different age classes. So, for example, in the 15 to 19-year-olds, which is the red line here, a couple of years after 2007, it starts to decline. because you're vaccinating at age 12, and in 2010, those growth hormones now become 15. So it starts to decline here, and it declines pretty rapidly. Now let's look at the older age classes. So we have some age sort of mixing pattern here. Most individuals choose sexual partners within plus or minus 5 years of their own age, with males tending to be a little bit older. So 11 years later, let's look at what's happening, say, in the orange age class, which is 35 to 39. So 11 years after the program is implemented, we start to see a gradual decline in the number of cases in 35 to 39-year-olds. 22 years later, there's another change where it starts to decline even more rapidly. Now, 22 years after the program has been implemented, let's see, that's if it was implemented in 2007 when those girls were 12, then 22 years later, they're 35. And so what's happening with this more rapid decline here is that this age class of women is made up out of women who were vaccinated when they were younger, so they have lower prevalence. But that doesn't explain this decline here. In other words, women aged 35 to 39 are experiencing decreased prevalence of infection, even if they haven't been vaccinated. Okay, so that's a herd immunity. So herd immunity is basically working its way up the age distribution. And because you have a fair bit of turnover in these age classes, and because there's not always an exact match between the age of the male and the female, older women are experiencing the benefits of vaccination in younger women via their male partners. Okay, so these are the kind of questions that you can then go back to a pathologist and you can say, well, we expect lesions to start declining in this age class in this year, for example, if that's useful to them. Okay, another example, the eradication equation, written here on a dinner napkin. So this is the famous eradication equation. The portion that must be immune to eradicate infection is 1 minus 1 over R0. And this is actually subject to some bias as well if there's age variation. The eradication equation is derived from an SIR model with no age structure. And it implicitly assumes that mixing does not vary according to age, and the force of infection does not vary according to age. But the force of infection for many diseases may actually decline with age for many infections. Just think about common childhood diseases where children transmit more and get infected more because of their hygiene and perhaps their biological factors than adults. So in the case of many childhood infections, the force of infection is actually declining with age. Moreover, the mean age of infection A is inversely proportional to the force of infection. You can derive that from the model. So as the force of infection goes down, the average age at which people get infected goes up. So what happens when you start to vaccinate? Well, vaccinating not only decreases the force of infection, but it also increases the mean age of infection through this equation. So vaccination is pushing infection into age classes where less disease gets transmitted anyway. So it's actually a compounding effect of vaccinating when the force of infection declines with age. Therefore, the eradication equation overestimates the critical proportion that you have to immunize to eradicate infection. Of course, there are other things that make it an underestimate, but I won't get into that. Here's another example. If you introduce age structure, you can change the time between outbreaks. So for example, this is a model with age structure. You have outbreaks of measles every 2 years, exactly every 2 years, and that's pretty consistent with empirical patterns. If you take out the age structure, it lengthens out to every 3 years, which is less typical for measles. So again, age structure can qualitatively change your predicted dynamics. Okay, a little bit about risk structure. So I've already given some examples of how risk structure can result in qualitative differences in predictions. The example of core groups was one example of that, where the heterogeneous model might predict persistence because you have this small island of high mixtures that are preserving the infection. So these types of core groups effects have been analyzed, and they've also looked for empirical evidence of them. So here's an example of an HIV model where you have a population structured into a small high-risk group, and these are people who share needles or have high unsafe sex, levels of unsafe sex, and a larger low-risk group. And what you can do is you can play with the assumptions about the mixing between the groups. For example, if the between group mixing is small, so that's risk authoritative. In other words, most people prefer to mix with individuals in their own group. Then individuals in the core group are nearly all infected before the infection moves into lower risk groups. By comparison, if between group mixing is large, so you have a lot of interactions between low-risk and high-risk individuals, then you have a lot more low-risk individuals who will be infected in the early stages of the epidemic. And the epidemic moves much faster because there is a larger pool of low-risk lower-risk individuals to feed it. And this has, you can look at the early stages of the HIV epidemic and think about, you know, which picture is more consistent with which mixing assumption. And of course, what happened early in HIV is that the virus very rapidly ate its way through gay men, and then it started to spread and is spreading in heterosexual populations. So the early stage of global HIV epidemic seemed more consistent with the low mixing, the risk of sordidness case, than with the random mixing case. And of course, we know in actual fact that people do tend to practice risk sort of mixing. Okay, the final point is stochasticity. So recall that I discussed at the beginning different types of compartmental models. In one case, you have an ODE model where you have an implied exponential distribution of the amount of time spent in the infected period. And you can also look at models where it's distributed according to, say, like an Erlang distribution or chi-square, et cetera. And if you do that, you often don't change the endemic equilibria or the R0 values. So when SARS came about, I think super spreaders essentially came into the parlance to a significant extent. So because there were cases where a few individuals infected a huge number of others, but most people didn't infect anyone. And there was a paper in 2005 that said, well, you know, this is actually pretty common for a lot of infections. It was known to be common for STIs, but actually it happens for measles and smallpox and monkeypox as well, which was, I think, surprised a lot of people. So here, for example, is a distribution of the number of secondary cases for SARS. As you can see, most people infect between 0 and 5 individuals. And then you have three people out here who infected 20 to 25 individuals. Okay, so these were the super spreaders. So you would characterize this as a highly skewed distribution. Here's another way to conceptualize that. On the horizontal axis, we have the proportion of infectious cases, and here we have the expected proportion of transmission caused by those. So for example, if people do not differ at all in how many infections they create, then this is a perfect line, because the proportion of infectious cases increases in exact proportion to the proportion of transmission that's attributed to them. But if you have something like SARS, this is curved up, because 20% of infectious cases cause around 80% of all the transmission. But it's also curved upward for measles, almost as much as SARS for that matter. In that case, about 20% of cases of measles cause about 80% of measles transmission. Okay, now if you take these kinds of skewed distributions and you put them in a model that has stochasticity, again, some interesting differences emerge. Compared to models that are based on averages, like a deterministic model, models that account for super spreading predict that disease extinction is more likely and outbreaks are less common. And you can see that in this plot here. This shows the R0 versus the probability of extinction. The red line is a highly dispersed curve, and you can see it here in the plot here. So most people infect a few, and then you have a few people infecting more than that. So for the red curve, which is highly skewed, the probability of extinction is very high. As you go down, you're getting less and less heterogeneity. Down here, you have a purple curve, and that corresponds to this spike here. So each person affects exactly 1.5 others. In the case of the purple curve, the probability of extinction goes down as the R0 goes up. So that makes intuitive sense based on what we know from compartmental models, stochastic models with non-skew distributions. The more transmissible, the more likely the outbreak is to be successful. So that's the downside, I guess you could say, or maybe not, of more skewed distributions. But the other aspect is that if an outbreak does occur, it's more explosive. It spreads much more rapidly. And that's what we see in this plot here. Here we have a different level of skew. This is, again, the most skewed, and this is the least skewed. And this basically is the first generation with 100 cases. In other words, it's basically a measure of how quickly the infection is spreading. So for example, if the 30th generation has 100 cases, then it's been taking quite a while to spread. But if the 10th generation has 100 cases, that means it's been spreading much more quickly. And as you can see, when epidemics do occur, they start much more quickly and they grow much more rapidly for the highest skew case. So this is important because it has implications for control. If you can have a targeted strategy that can find individuals who are super spreaders, then that's going to be much more effective. And in fact, if you compare targeted to non-targeted strategies with a homogeneous mixing model, you're going to get the efficacy of the targeted strategy incorrect. So this again illustrates that when you're building more heterogeneity into the model, sometimes at some point something changes. So in this case, we added distributions, nothing really changed. We added stochasticity, and then some interesting things changed. In conclusion, been pretty good for time. So these are common heterogeneities, and when you introduce heterogeneity in a population, you first decide how am I stratifying it. You can do it by space, by contacts, by age or by risk. You can even do it by strain. I didn't really talk much about that, but that's obviously relevant to drug resistance. And then you have to make assumptions about whether or not the mixing is dependent on this new population structure. Does stochasticity matter for your question, and do the parameter values change over time? So I go back to the original question, when does heterogeneity matter? My answer is that it really depends on the objective of the modeling. There's one case where you absolutely need it, and that's if you're interested in these outcomes in specific groups, or if you want to compare interventions applied in different groups. So for example, if you want to know whether you should vaccinate at age 9 or age 12 for hepatitis A, you have to have age structure. If you want to predict how fast rabies is going to spread across space, you have to have spatial structure, etc. Sometimes you're lucky, and this extra heterogeneity in the structure doesn't translate into complexities in terms of modeling transmission. Measles is a good example of that. Measles is highly transmissible, and I feel that an age-structured model does a pretty good job of predicting the impact of the vaccine in a given population. But in terms of measles outcomes, there's a lot of heterogeneity. A child is much less likely to die if they're well-nourished than if they're malnourished, or if they're free of other infections or parasitic infections. So, for example, that's why you see an order of magnitude difference in case fatality rates here for measles versus some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where it can be up to 10% in very impoverished populations. So in that example, you might want to use an age-structured model that predicts infection of cases, but you don't have to worry about whether a malnourished kid mixes differently from a well-nourished kid. You know, there is some differences in mixing, but perhaps it doesn't matter as much. As you can see, it's there's always trade-offs. However, if you want to get the dynamics right, then it's a much tougher choice. Okay, so if you really need to predict how many cases there are going to be in 3 weeks during an outbreak, for example, then there are basically no principles. There are only rules of thumb. And there are always trade-offs for simple versus complex models that you can't get around. So, for example, a simpler model has less heterogeneity, with less heterogeneity, much easier to analyze, more robust, fewer parameters. Thanks to Occam's razor, sometimes they do a good job of predicting what you need, but they may miss important features. Excuse me. On the other hand, for a model with more heterogeneity, they're harder to analyze. But they can capture important features, but you have to be ready to pay attention to all the parameters that you've introduced and think about sensitivity analysis and validation. So there are always trade-offs. And of course, there are always biases. If all you have is a hammer, every problem becomes a nail, right? And that's true in infectious disease modeling as well. So there are biases according to methodology, and there are also biases according to background. For example, many biologists insist that everything has to be in the model, or if not, it's a piece of junk. It's not a simple issue, which is why I have a job. What are some of the solutions? There are ways to kind of to work around some of these problems. For example, I think the model should always be tied closely to the objectives. I think if the models are closely tied to your objectives, then you're more likely to make the right choice. So, for example, if you only want to illustrate a certain principle, you're better off with a simpler model that can capture the salient features of the system rather than going for a model with all the bells and whistles. It just also depends on who's using the model. Some policymakers are interested in very complex models with all the bells and whistles. Some might be more interested in getting insights, like, you know, what is nonlinearity, and what does it mean for the impact of vaccination, in which case you might use a simpler model more as a teaching tool. You need to use guidance from the literature. So people have thought about this a lot. They've published a lot on it. The literature is enormous. It's absolutely vast. And over time, if you read enough of this stuff, you'll kind of get a picture and intuition for when you need a certain type of heterogeneity and when you don't. And finally, this is a collaborative research era. So compare the models. Okay, so work with people who have different types of models, and look at the outcomes and see if they're really that different. And if they are different, then you should get to the bottom of that. So that's about it, and I think we have 3 minutes for questions. Thank you.